Hello, everybody. What a nice big crowd. This is the end of our 10-day Emerging Sangha Leadership Retreat.
We're all really tired, but we're also pretty satisfied. It was really a terrific retreat. We hosted 12 people from around the United States and Canada to come and share and learn about how their sanghas work and how they can move into leadership. So you're going to hear from three people today, brief talks, and I'm going to let Bibiana start.
Questions at the end.
And a few questions at the end. I'm going to put it up high. That's great.
Hello. Good morning. Is the sound okay in the back? Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Bibiana Vera. I come from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and the name of my sangha is True North Insight. Let's take a moment to arrive. Let's take a few deep breaths. Feel the weight of the body wherever you are sitting, the pressure of the chair, of the cushion beneath you, the temperature of the air on your skin, the subtle rising and falling of the breath. I'd like to share some words about a practice that has been present for me in recent times. It's the four elements. These are earth, water, fire, and air. They are mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse of the foundations of mindfulness, which is a systematical, practical set of instructions to develop attention. And among these teachings, the Buddha suggests contemplating the body in terms of these four elements. I'd like to evoke these elements as an accessible way of investigating the nature of experience. And by investigating, I mean being in contact with the felt experience of having a body, of being a sensitive creature. The body is a very concrete field of exploration. It can lead us to deep understanding of reality. Everything we need can be found here and now in this body. In the morning, we chant, the four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to her mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. We refer to a fundamental basic component, the building blocks of experience. In this context, we are not referring to components such as atoms of molecules, but rather to fundamental qualities or properties of experience. This points to the idea that these qualities are present in one way or another in every experience. They are an accessible, palpable, precise, embodied way to map sensory experience for qualities of sensation that we can feel at any given moment. Earth is solid. Earth is the quality of solidity, harshness, resistance, or the opposite, in the absence, softness, pliability. In the body, we can feel it in the bones, in the teeth, in the weight of the body. Please take a moment to feel a sense of solidity in your body. Water wets. Water is the quality of liquidity and cohesion. It flows and it holds things together. We feel this element in the fluid quality of the blood or the saliva. Water is also present in the elasticity of tissue. When we inhale and the belly expands without breaking, this is the cohesive quality of water. Fire heats. Fire represents temperature in all its gradations, heat and its absence, cold. The body naturally radiates heat we can feel it if we rub each hand together. Please do so if you wish to. Fire also points to the metabolic energy that animates life, like digestion or breathing. Wind moves. Air is movement, vibration, pressure. The rise and fall of the chest, the body running through the veins, the beating heart. This practice is valuable because it enables us to engage with sensations without adopting a conceptual or descriptive approach. We just need to feel. The elements give us a direct preconceptual vocabulary for making sense of experience, one that penetrates what is being felt, not through analysis, but through contact. When uncomfortable or painful sensations arise, the mind might create stories around them. For me, for example, when a migraine arises, it's common to project to the future, create catastrophic scenarios, such as this is going to last for several days, I'm not going to be able to show up as I want to, this body is defective. Or project into the past, creating stories of guilt, blame, shame, I should not have eaten all that chocolate. I get migraines at the worst of times. Something is wrong with me. None of this is true or beneficial. There is another way to relate to experience. For example, instead of a story, I could notice the play of these four elements. It is possible to interrupt the train of thought by examining the felt experience. This could look like asking questions. Is this sensation hard or soft? That is earth. Is there a sense of flow or moisture? That would be water. Is there heat or coolness? That's fire. Is there movement or pressure? This is air. A migraine is throbbing, burning, squeezing. A congested nose is pulsating, wetness, a sense of hindered flow. We may also notice presence and absence. Not every element is equally prominent in every moment. Sometimes one quality dominates and another recedes. And when attention is refined, when we stay in contact with the qualities of sensation, with curiosity, without turning away, we may notice that experience is not fixed. What seemed like solid shifts. What is burning cools down. What is wet dries. There is the possibility of experiencing impermanence not as a concept or description, but as something felt in the body, in real time, moment by moment. In the same sutta, the Buddha invites us to practice with the elements both internally within the body and externally in the world around us. The same qualities define what we meet outside of our bodies, in the environment and in other bodies. There is solidity in the tree, there is earth in its structure, water soaks its roots, branches turn slowly towards the sun, energy is transformed through photosynthesis. Same qualities, no difference. Same elements, no separation. As I have been sitting with the elements, I noticed that the same map can be turned toward inner experience. We can investigate the presence of the elements in emotions, attitudes, and mental states as they arise and pass. Consider the rigidity of an opinion, not as a metaphor, but as an actual quality of the experience. Or the heaviness of grief, the way it is, has an earth quality, a density to it. The agitation of insomnia, restlessness, a mind that cannot settle. Could this be wind? Or the way curiosity has a water-like quality and penetrates experience. We don't need to name an emotion precisely, There is no need to decide whether this is anxiety or grief or something else entirely. We only need to ask, what is the quality here? Is this heavy or light? Is this contracted or pervading? Moving or still, warm or cold? That question alone can create a significant gap, a moment from stepping back from the story and being able to observe it. The state might still be present, but we are no longer caught in it. The pain is still there, but we are no longer identifying to it. A different way of relating to experience becomes possible. Whether we are noticing the elements show up in the body, the mind, or the landscape around us, this practice points toward a liberating recognition. When we meet pain or discomfort as an elemental quality, such as heat, pressure, wetness, or movement, it can become a natural process rather than an identity. The story falls away. It is possible to remain in contact with the present, noticing only the felt qualities of an experience. Earth, water, wind, and fire. And also noticing them arise and pass. A congested nose becomes awareness in which wetness arose and passed. By using the elements as a map to know experience, not only am I able to step back from the story, but I might also witness impermanence more clearly. With curious attention, the pain or discomfort can lose its intensity. It peaks, it shifts, it dissipates. This is the potential gift of the elements. They do not invite me to transcend what is happening, but they invite me to meet it directly, closely, without interpreting, analyzing, or judging. And in that meeting, I may discover that I am able to be with pain without adding a layer of harm to self or others, simply by letting it run its course. The same attention can be turned towards what is wholesome. The elements are also present in kindness, in compassion, in the cooling of what has been burning. One of our morning chants offers a beautiful image about this. Let's take a few breaths and let's settle these words. The precepts of compassion roar like thunder, the kind heart wondrous as great clouds, pouring dharma rain of sweet dew, quenching all flames of troubling passion.
Good morning. My name's Tokushu Egan. I'm visiting you from Seattle. Seattle Soto Zen is the place where I practice. My teacher and home temple is Berkeley Zen Center. I should warn you, I'm a bucket of salt water, and if you tip me at all, it'll come out my eyes. So I've learned to be okay with that, and I hope you are too. When I first came to practice, I felt immensely welcome. I would find myself weeping in Dharma talks, not really knowing why. That hasn't really changed. But, you know, the sensation was pain and sorrow, but also joy and relief. I dove into reading as much as I could. I watched carefully in the sessions where people were asking questions, and when I felt safe, I began to ask questions myself. And I felt like this practice was almost perfect, except for the bowing and the chanting. I really wasn't so sure about that. So if you're new here and you're feeling like those things might be a barrier, or maybe it would be better if we dispensed with them altogether. I feel you. That was my experience when I started. And what I'd like to talk about today is how that opened for me, my experience of the forms opening and becoming a really vital and important part of my practice. it may not be surprising that that was my experience, because I came to practice in May of 2020. And I was bowing and chanting by myself in my office. I couldn't chant with my ears because it was just me and it sounded really awkward. I should also say, I'm really grateful that we had that interregnum. I don't know if I ever would have made it to a Zendo. I have pretty strong social anxiety, and the thought of a ritualized space where I didn't know what I was supposed to do was really physically terrifying for me. It took 2 years for me to actually arrive in the physical Zendo. That was in a Sangha Week experience at Green Gulch Farm. I jumped right into the deep end there. I have some funny stories of things that happened on that trip, but one of the things I wanted to relate to you was, in the first morning, the first service I experienced in person, I saw the abbot bow. And I'd never seen something like that. It was a complete movement. It was completely embodied. It was without pretense or self-consciousness. There was nothing performative about it. It was just this miraculous, sincere movement. And I was deeply touched by it. And I felt this curiosity, like, how do you learn to bow like that? I have always had a deep well of sincerity. It's been part of my character, even though in my teens and 20s and 30s, I adopted a mask of cynicism to try and hide that. When I was in sixth grade, I played hockey, and some of the kids on the hockey bus, we decided, for a little while, like we would moon the cars that were following the hockey bus. And one day, one of those cars followed us back to the school, and that person was pretty upset. And they went to the administrators, and they sat us down and said, "Nobody's leaving this room till the kids who are responsible come forward." And I was the only one who came forward. Everyone knew that I wasn't the only one who'd done it. And somehow the teachers and administrators were content to punish me by myself, and were unable to acknowledge that was a brave and sincere thing to come forward. And it took me a long time to recognize that quality in myself as a through line of character. I got in a lot of trouble, and I took on the sense that I was a bad kid. And I had an experience. There was something I meant to mention. While I was practicing at home, another opening, I came across a teaching from Suzuki Roshi where he said that he could watch his students bow and tell which of them were resistant and which of them were over-compliant, and this idea that the forms were a way of studying ourselves just kind of sat with me, like, that's an interesting thing. And I had the opportunity to be deeply with that in December. I got to go to Austin Zen Center. I don't get to practice in person with my teacher very often, and she was a guest teacher there in the fall and asked me to come be the Jisha for the Rahatsu Sesshin, which was wonderful, except that I don't know the forms of that temple, and our home temple is very, very loose with the forms. And so, I was handling, we don't use incense I was handling incense for the first time. I didn't know what to do with it. It was very, very, I was nervous, and I really, really wanted to do it right. And, you know, I got to watch that grasping come up over and over again as I fumbled my way through these forms. You know, I had the experience at Green Gulch, at Tassajara, another Sangha week. I didn't realize that the custom there was that if you encounter another person, you stop and you bow. And it was really awkward, you know, the first time that happened. And as I adopted and began to practice that, that practice, I was deeply moved by it. The sense of mutuality, and the sense that that wasn't inherent in the action, that we each brought something to that activity. I began to feel the sincerity of other people's practice through the forms. The Dharma gate of the intellect, this is my experience, is a wall. And I had to beat my head against that wall for a long time before I began to have an experience of embodied practice. And that embodiment first came through the feeling of encouragement that I felt from watching other people embody the forms, the bowing at Tassajara, the precision of it, and the care with which the Doshi would make an offering. It opened this sense that was beyond the frustration that I was having of, you know, thinking through Zazen. And it was very supportive. I felt held in the container of that, and deeply encouraged. You know, my teacher talks about the formlessness of forms, you know, and I think that what she means by that, you know, the forms of this temple are different, you know, than my home temple or Austin, that there's nothing inherently magical about, you know, the specific movement. It's what we bring to it. And the sense that these physical practices are a container into which we pour our sincerity and aspiration, and having felt sense of the encouragement I've felt from people in this room, I feel a deep desire to share that gift. So in closing, I want to say two things. Something my teacher often says to me, and something that our teacher in Seattle often says to the Sangha. Thank you for your sincere practice. And take very good care of yourselves.
The sound okay? Okay. My name is Soki. I practice with Brightway Zen over on the west side. So I'm going to talk about staying connected to the precepts. And for those who may be new to Zen, the precepts are the moral and ethical guidelines we follow as Zen Buddhists. But I'm going to use a funny tool. I want to talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect quickly. I'm checking if there's a recognition in faces. Yeah, okay. Well, Maybe forget what you know, because I'm going to appropriate it for my own benefit. But it's a cognitive bias, and it describes a tendency of people with low ability and a certain skill to perceive that skill is much higher than it really is. My example is new drivers. It was drilled into me in driver's ed that new drivers are way too confident. But actually, it can also refer to folks who have actually, you know, they're high performers and they underestimate their skills. So I have a visual for you all. Can you grab that for me? This is going to be maybe the first and only time you see a graph in a Dharma talk. So I'll just maybe, sure, if someone... Okay, so I'm going to talk about this a little bit. Thank you. So on the bottom, we have competence. That's our skill. As you go left, I guess it's your right. That's higher competence. On the vertical axis, we have confidence. So the higher you go up, that's higher confidence, right? So that very first, I guess this is like a pink X, that very first X, that's where our new drivers are at. Too much confidence, very low competence. And then our new driver gets in an accident or gets a ticket and it plummets. Oh, I should say that this is called Mount Stupid. Now this valley here, this is the valley of despair. That's when our new driver gets a ticket, they get an accident, their confidence plummets. They're very aware of how little they know. But you'll notice it is a little higher on the competence. So it is a sign of growth. We have the slope of enlightenment. That's this green X. That's funny because I didn't come up with that. That just comes with the Dunning-Kruger effect. But enlightenment is a loaded term. But this is when you have a more realistic relationship with your competence and confidence, and you're learning quickly. And then we have the plateau sustainability up here. And this is, you know, in your day job, these are your subject matter experts. They really know everything that they need to know to be successful. Life is good. So I'm going to use it to discuss my relationship with the precepts. And maybe for this conversation, we'll switch out. Yeah, you can put it down. Okay. We can switch out competence and maybe talk about, like, maybe that can be connectedness or aliveness with the precepts. And if you want to look at this and maybe kind of consider where you fall, you could think about that for a minute or a moment. But I'll talk about my relationship with this. So when I first started out with the precepts, I did not resonate with them. I don't like rules. I didn't understand how we could spend so much time studying these. How are there so many books on the precepts? I thought they were easy, straightforward, and I didn't need them. I was on the peak of Mount Stupid. Over time, I broke precepts. Despite the fact that I thought that they were so easy, I was stumbling around in my own conditioning, not paying attention. And so when that would happen, I would hang out in the valley of despair. And even though it's sad here, it's quite comfortable. There's nowhere to fall. And I think we can spend a lot of time here if we're not careful. I know I've spent whole seasons here beating myself up, kind of decorating the place and getting comfy. And then there's the plateau. You know, when I think I'm a subject matter expert on a precept, I think I have a full grasp on it. And what happens here is I'm robbing myself of an opportunity to continue shaping a relationship with the precept. I may even have a deep understanding of the precept, but the precepts are limited and I'm always changing. Things are always changing. And I just wanted to bring up an example. The first grave precept is do not kill. Okay, great. Don't murder people and eat vegetarian. All done. Yeah. But compare that to the perspective of how Diane Rossetto describes staying connected to the precept in her precept book. Watch for the ways you wage war in everyday events. A spilled glass of milk, a coworker who threatens to take a promotion you're hoping for, a store clerk who insults you. What are your weapons and how do they escalate as the perceived threat grows stronger? Does your shouting shoot down your child's explanation of how the milk spilled? Do you find ways to kill your coworker's chance for advancement or come back with a cutting comment to the insult? Maybe you will not pick up a gun or strike with a bat, but you will kill, but will you kill with your mind? So that just opens up a really rich connection. And by deciding on an interpretation of the precepts and washing my hands of it, I'm just right back at Mount Stupid. So maybe this plateau is actually Mount Stupid 2.0 and the practice just goes on and on. I do want to say, I forgot to say this earlier, that comparing anything related to the Dharma on a graph is a trap. The Dharma is not two-dimensional and practice is not linear. So, and whatever analogy, if you look at it too hard, it starts to fall apart. So just hold this really loosely in your mind. So when you define a precept and call it done and you just move on, Shinryu Suzuki calls that legalizing the precepts. And, you know, in my practice, I'm trying to break down fixed views and pre-existing ideas. And when I legalize the precepts, I'm just adding them to the pile of crap that I'm trying to clean up. And so Shinryu Suzuki says the best way to practice the precepts is to forget them. Forget what you think you know. Stay connected and curious and do whatever it takes to hold on to that beginner's mind. And as a wrap up, just another point that I think should be made here is that this can and should be lighthearted. Falling into the pit of despair from anywhere on this graph is painful, but it's okay. It's a sign of growth. But hanging out there is not a sustainable place to be, and you're not connected to the precepts, just like when you think you totally get it. So this is important work, and take care of yourself.
All right. So we have three speakers today. If you have a question or comment, feel free to raise your hand. When I give you the mic, please hold it close to your mouth and share your name. And let's see. So Viviana was our first speaker. Second speaker, will you remind me of your name?
Soki.
Tokushu. And Soki was our third speaker. So if you have a direct question and you can remember their name, feel free to direct it. And if you're online, our Zoom co-host can unmute you if you want to ask your question. So type your name in the chat or type your question or comment in the chat and they'll read it for us.
Hi, this is Genko. This is for Soki. This one resonated for me because the second time I drove, I took out a gas station.
An entire gas station?
Well, no, just a couple of the pumps and an oil stand in between them. And my mother was trying to teach me, and she didn't have a clue how to teach someone. I mean, she had me out on country roads and like steering and all of that. And then she said, oh, let's try it in town. And she says, oh, we need air in the tires. Go into this gas station. I had no idea how to go into a gas station. You usually start with parking, so you have a sense of how the car moves. And I didn't have any idea. So I'm going in there at 25 miles an hour. It's like, that did not work. So, but I don't know that I got to the depths of despair. I mean, I did in a way. I felt horrible. And it didn't help that somebody pointed out that, you know, One of the attendants had run inside and turned off the gas when they saw me coming, which was a good thing because they emphasized that I could have had caused an explosion and really like caused a lot of problems. So I'm sitting there going, oh man, you know, I'm cause of disasters, right? So, but of course, my father insisted that I get right back into the car and go out and drive again. He had a little more sense maybe about how to do this. I don't know. But in any case, I was not allowed to stay there, which I now am glad of. You know, it actually was good. It gave me a lot of information about the power of a car. And I think that's one of the things that happens is that we say, okay, I'm going to learn this thing. And then we mess it up royally. And it's kind of like, oh, it's a lot harder than I thought. That's definitely true for the precepts. I have definitely felt that. When I first came to the Zen Center, I thought, oh, I can do this. This is forms. Hey, that's easy. All I have to do is follow the forms and I'm good, right? And well, it took a while for me to realize it's not easy at all. So I appreciate this. This is a kind of an interesting graph, and I will keep this in mind. I'm teaching the precepts right now in prison, so it'll be something to bring to that. So I thank you for this.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Yukio. I have a question for Tokushu. I appreciated you speaking about bowing. Someone asked me, some time ago, like, what are you thinking about when you're bowing? Like, what is bowing like for you? And I would like to turn that question around to you because of what you spoke about. So what's bowing like for you?
I try not to think, which isn't to say it doesn't happen. You reminded me, my teacher once said that our job in the Sangha, when the Doshi is doing the offering, is to, how did she say it, enact the unimaginable. I'm still working on that. I feel like bringing up the sincerity of practice is what I try to bring to the act of bowing.
Hi, I'm Haley. I just wanted to say another thing about like Mount Stupid. I've been finding that out a little bit. I've been having like swallowing troubles lately, and that's like something I've been able to do for like 30 years, I would think. So thinking about a lot, like, okay, which one's the air hole? Which one's and am I swallowing right? Should I drink more water with this? Yeah, so it is just like interesting, like how even when it comes to things that you take for granted and you thought, oh, that's a reflex, I don't even have to think about that. It's just like, I don't know. But I guess that kind of reminds me of like just like with our practice, like going back to our breath, like how do you breathe well? Like, you know, I don't know if that makes sense. So I just, a little bit in that pit of despair. So, yeah.
This is like infinitely applicable. I actually, thank you. I actually thought about applying this to the forms as well. I think this, you can talk about this in any area of life. Yeah.
This is Jacqueline. My question's for Bibiana. I have recently, I guess, within the last, I don't know, 10 years of my life, which is recent, discovered little by little the capacity to go into the body to feel rather than go into story. And I'm really grateful for that practice. But prior to that, I found that I was so disconnected from my body, like so in story, and that the body was not even a safe place to be. So if you had asked me to do that 10 years ago, I would have been like, I feel nothing. So I'm curious, like how would you invite somebody who feels nothing into this practice?
Thank you for your question, Jacqueline. I would suggest sitting in silence
doing nothing and seeing what comes up, feeling the breath, what we do. Like, this is the way into embodiment. For me, the practice of Zazen is embodiment. Does it
respond? Thank you. I think that may be something that folks can access about just sitting and noticing their body in sitting. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, I do. The breath.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Suho, and more of a comment, kind of connected to Soki, to your talk of the precepts. I've always thought about do not steal. I love do not kill because we're cutting something off. A lot of times we're pushing something away, but to say do not steal, usually we're taking something from someone else. And, you know, it's easy to think that it's money or their home or whatever else, but we can take people's dignity. I like the much broader definition of these questions around precepts. So I really appreciate you bringing that out. And I think every one of the precepts has that much broader version that we could think about as we're trying to practice with them.